Arsenal for Democracy is available twice a week. There's a free episode at arsenalfordemocracy.com or Apple or Stitcher each weekend, and a midweek bonus episode at patreon.com/arsenalfordemocracy, available for $5 a month. The show is recorded and produced by me, Bill Humphrey, in Newton, Massachusetts. Our theme music is produced by Stunt Bird. Follow us on Facebook or at AFD Radio on Twitter. The show is not affiliated with any campaign committee, and each participant's opinions are their own.
This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, episode 374, recorded on May 16th, 2021. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me on the line from New York City is Kelly. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, Bill.
So we're talking this week about the Emergency Quota Act of 1921, which was enacted on May 21st, 1921, 100 years ago this week, under President Harding, after being blocked the previous year by Woodrow Wilson. And this legislation, which, as we'll talk about, had some more famous successor legislation, but is really influential on those successor legislations, restricted the number of immigrants admitted from any country annually to 3% of the number of residents from that country living in the United States as of the 1910 census. Now, I want you to note here the use of 1910, not 1920. I believe that the 1920 results, which we'll be talking a lot more about the 1920 census on our bonus episode this week, had not come back yet at the point when this was being debated in Congress and signed. So they were using the most recently available data of 1910. But there were some problems with this. A lot of that we're going to talk about in our 1920 census episode later this week. But suffice it to say here that residents of one of the approximately 27 newly created or significantly expanded countries after World War I were to be counted on the basis of the new country's quotas as adjusted for estimates of population in 1910 from those geographical areas, which must have been quite difficult since the 1910 census, as far as I was able to figure out, did not ask that level of detail. If the person was of foreign birth, they gave their country, they gave their language, but they did not give their subdivision of origin, their city of origin, or anything like that, which would have been useful for trying to figure out what country they had come from after the fact, after the countries were redrawn. Again, we will be talking about that more on our 1920 census episode later this week. But again, to make this point clear up front in the intro, this was a very difficult proposition to write the law this way, given the significant number of changes that had happened, and in many cases, the focus on curbing immigration from those particular countries, which were continuing to experience a high level of instability, either from general economic problems from having been carved up or whatever, or from ongoing civil wars, revolutions, and wars over the exact borders with their neighbors. So, Kelly, before we get into some of those more detailed numbers, can you give us some of the political factors leading to this sort of sense of crisis that there was some sort of immigration emergency that needed to be dealt with through a system of quotas?
Absolutely. And like they say, history doesn't repeat itself, but it does rhyme. And I kept thinking of that as we researched this act today. Like other racist immigration actions, they were the result of decades of scapegoating of the immigration population. The end of World War I in the United States was a difficult time as the government, the military, obviously demobilized. People who had been enlisted in the army began to look for work. And unemployment rose to about 20%. This was partnered with soaring consumer prices, with some things costing as much as 105% as their pre-war prices. So it was a pretty difficult time for the American public. People didn't have jobs, and even if they did have jobs, they didn't have livable wages. And so as a result, in 1919, unions staged a series of strikes in order to bring wages up with the cost of consumer goods. Folks just wanted to be able to make a living wage. these union strikes, of course, as they were designed to do, did disrupt parts of the American economy. This was partnered with some growing political movements, and mail bombs were sent from anarchists, or folks that are most simply described as anarchists. These mail bombs were sent to a series of politicians, and on June 2nd, bombs were detonated in 8 cities. You can hear more about this on a previously recorded Arsenal for Democracy episode from August 19th that we will, of course, link in the notes. Along with this this anarchist activity, there was this rise of so-called scientific racism. People were using the scientific method for the first time, but in ways that were quite inappropriate. And even the U.S. Senate got in on this racism. And in 1911, the U.S. Immigration Commission found that the world could be divided into a 5-tier race class system. Of course, these tiers were not equal, and there was a lot of racist thoughts reflected into this finding from the U.S. Senate. On top of this, and I will say that all of this building racism over the decades before, this resulted in attempts for like literacy tests as part of the immigration process. But at the time, presidents on both sides of the aisle felt that immigrations were so essential to the economy that it wasn't worth sort of instituting these racist policies in order to stem the flow of immigration. This all sort of changed what was called the Red Scare, which was particularly prominent in 1919, which saw thousands of immigrant radicals deported and many more arrested and imprisoned. So folks that were getting involved in anarchist and communist efforts in the United States were deported back to their home country. The Assistant Secretary of Labor, Mr. Lewis Post, deemed the reaction a deportation delirium, and the delirium expressed itself in ugly ways. So all of this was sort of building. People were feeling scared of their neighbor. There was economic discontent. And as happened so many times throughout history in this sort of setting, the immigrations became the scapegoat. So I'm just going to read a brief quote from a Politico article that I found so resonant because it felt like it could have been written this year. In this environment, immigrants were an easy target. Roughly 14.5 million newcomers, most of them Catholics and Jews from Southern and Eastern Europe, had arrived in the United States since 1900, transforming overnight the nation's ethnocultural identity. In 1910, almost 15% of all residents were foreign-born, a figure that didn't account for their American-born children. The influx created a powerful backlash, as ordinary people felt themselves stripped of economic and political autonomy in a rapidly industrializing and urbanizing nation. It was all too tempting to seek out scapegoats. As early as the 1890s, the Immigration Restriction League, powered by wealthy Boston businessmen and political elites, clamored for restrictions. Prescott Hall, the IRL's co-founder, asked whether the U.S. historically peopled by British, German, and Scandinavian stock, historically free, energetic, and progressive, be overrun by Slav, Latin, and Asiatic races, historically downtrodden, atavistic, and stagnant. So you can sort of hear the racism in just that one quote. But this is so resonant today because we hear things like, oh, what's going to happen when more than half of the United States isn't white anymore? What's going to happen as we see sort of the demographics of the United States shifting? And so while this happened 100 years ago, this act of 1921, many of these themes are still certainly present today. As for the text of the legislation itself, the key part really was this 3% rule. So based on the 1910 census results, this was going to determine the number of immigrants that were allowed from any particular nationality. And so whatever the numbers were in the 1910 results, 3% of that was the quota, the annual quota of people allowed in. So if, 100 folks from Italy resided in the United States in 1910, then 3 folks from Italy would be allowed in each year. And so this was really obviously designed to keep the national and ethnic makeup of the United States the same, and to not allow for these changes that people saw happening so rapidly in their backyard. There was an interesting sort of loophole within this related to Latin America and Canada. Bill, did you want to touch on that?
Yeah, so the Emergency Quota Act of 1921 did not restrict immigration from, quote, aliens who have resided continuously for at least 1 year immediately preceding the time of their admission to the United States in the Dominion of Canada, Newfoundland, the Republic of Cuba, the Republic of Mexico, countries of Central or South America, or adjacent islands. Now, Kelly, as you had noted looking through this, as with today, the southern border was a little bit harder to regulate than some of these other places. The labor was considered quite cheap as well and necessary in certain parts of the country, I'm sure, you know, especially if we're talking about agriculture. But it did create this sort of de facto loophole where, you know, if you spent a year in Canada or Mexico or Cuba and so forth, that you could get into the United States. And certainly with Mexico, we saw various groups of people who would live in Mexico for a while and then come to the U.S. subsequent to that. Another thing that I wanted to point out while you're talking about these 3% quotas, Kelly, is that, of course, there were entire areas of the world that were discriminated against even more than this and had zero immigration allowed to the United States. And that was under previous legislation that had been enacted. Before we were recording, Kelly and I were looking at the map of the 1917 immigration restrictions passed around the time of World War I, included things like the Asiatic Barred Zone, where they had literally drawn at a 90-degree angle on the broader area of China, Mongolia, Tibet, so forth, and said, if you are on this side of this angled line, these two lines that form an angle, then you are not allowed to come to the United States. And if you are on this side, then there are certain restrictions that apply. But you know, it's different rules, and they did not follow any particular boundary. They literally, someone had just gone on a straight edge across the map and then shaded in part of the map and said, you can't come here from this part of Asia, unless you are in, you know, the British or French colonies and so forth, in which case, again, different restrictions apply. And I'm sure that those countries had various restrictions rules and regulations on outflow from those countries. While we are acknowledging the obviously very discriminatory practices of the 1921 quotas, it should be underscored here that there were lots of countries where immigration was governed by a completely different set of rules that had nothing to do with these quotas and in many cases was prohibited completely, in large part due to the aforementioned sort of racial science categories that they were busy fictionally inventing at the time. So one interesting thing that I wanted to comment on and discuss with you, Kelly, while we're going over this topic today, is you've talked about sort of the political factors here, but some of the sort of paranoia and hysteria around it seems not to have been grounded in particularly clear actual facts about what was happening at the time. So you mentioned that long quote about, you know, that, oh, historically, you had the British, German, and Scandinavian people, and they had these such and such values, and then now we're being overrun by Slavs, Latins, and Asiatics, and so forth. And there's definitely, like, kernels where you can see what that kind of racist view is supposedly grounded in, not in the what the values meant, but in terms of the actual numbers. But in many cases, the level of freakout over the immigration, especially from Southern and Eastern European areas or the Middle East, is quite astonishing given the actual numbers and how low they were. So let's take a look at some of the highlights from 1910 and the 1920 censuses by first language of foreign-born population. Now, again, as a reminder, this law was based off the 1910 census, not the 1920 census, but would have been in reaction to the 1920 census, which hadn't come back yet, but they were anticipating what they thought it was going to be. With the benefit of hindsight, we, of course, can look at that and say what actually happened. So the number of Turkish-speaking immigrants grew from less than 5,000 to less than 7,000 in the entire United States. The number of Arabic-speaking immigrants, which would have been from places like Egypt, Lebanon, Syria, and so forth, those grew from 33,000 to 58,000. Even the purported Armenian surge was relatively small, obviously very important to the Armenian community in the United States, but still quite small in absolute numbers, even after the people escaping the Armenian genocide and so forth came to the existing Armenian diaspora communities. That grew from 24,000 to 38,000. Now, in many cases, again, the perception here was, oh, there's, you know, been so much chaos during and after the war. You got people fleeing these terrible conditions and ongoing military conflicts. So let's look at Hungary. That's a great example, or at least Hungarian speakers who were not necessarily the same as people from Hungary, because the borders of Hungary were being substantially modified during this period. And many people who spoke Hungarian and lived in these other countries, you might have thought, well, they're going to all rush to a country like the U.S. if they don't move to the new redrawn Hungary because they're trying to get away from persecution or whatever. And we did see a significant increase, but again, relatively small numbers. The change there was 229,000 to 290,000. So we're talking about, you know, about 30,000 change there. The number of Yiddish-speaking immigrants who were in many cases fleeing sort of post-war pogroms in whether it was, you know, local ones in Germany or in Poland or in some cases the situation in Russia, although I'm not going to speculate here because that's a little bit outside the scope in terms of when we're talking about the various, there was a lot of chaos going on with the Russian Civil War, so I don't want to get into who was controlling which areas and conducting pogroms or whatever, because that's outside of our scope. But that grew from 1.05 million to 1.09 million. Again, pretty small change we're talking about. Significant baseline, sure, but a small change over this period. The number of Italian-speaking immigrants grew from 1.4 million to 1.6 million. The number of Polish-speaking immigrants grew from 944,000 to 1.08 million. The number of Greek-speaking immigrants grew from 118,000 to 175,000. And that was, you know, maybe the numbers increased after this 1920 period because the war was still being wrapped up between Greece and Turkey. But that was like a particularly chaotic area as well. You might have expected to see pretty significant changes. And in fact, when the populations were forcibly exchanged as part of the border redrawing after the war between Greece and Turkey, I mean, we're talking about, you know, numbers on the order of hundreds of thousands to millions on either side being or on the combined sides being shifted. And we're not really seeing that reflected, at least here in these numbers. The number of Albanian speakers, you know, proportionally, oh, a huge change, almost doubled. But in absolute numbers, we're talking about 2,300 to 5,500. The number of Bulgarian speakers, a great example of a Slavic population and one that lost territory and was on the losing side of the war. And you might have expected an increase. We actually saw a decline from 18,000 dropped. The number of Slovenian speaking immigrants, which had been a relatively solid chunk of people in the United States, that actually declined from 123,000 with the integration of Slovenia into Yugoslavia. I guess some people went home to their home areas. Serbo-Croatians, or Bosnian-Serbian-Croatian is how we would refer to it today, that they barely increased to 126,000. Again, we're talking about, you know, relatively small numbers overall here. Russian speakers, you would think that's got to be like one of the biggest groups of Slavs, Slavic speakers in the country, or ethnic Slavs of however you want to define that under the 1920s fake race science stuff. They didn't even get to 400,000 people in the 1920 census. Again, we're talking about numbers that are just totally disproportionate in terms of perception versus reality. Ukrainians reached 55,000. That's still a pretty small number. And the census did break Czechs and Slovaks out separately as two different language groups, but because it became Czechoslovakia, I'm going to just combine these together to say 500,000 together. Again, not an enormous number. It's definitely a significant factor, but, you know, not huge. Romanians reached 62,000. I guess there wasn't a huge surge there. So some discussion points about this. Bear in mind, as we're talking about these numbers, that the total U.S. population in 1910 was 92 million, and in 1920 was 106 million. That's what we're talking about. If we're talking about, you know, a million immigrants here speaking this language and a million immigrants here speaking that language, or we're talking about 500,000, or we're talking about 50,000, measure that against that overall number that we're talking about 106 million people in 1920 in the U.S. population. Of the fewer than 14 million immigrants still in the U.S. in 1920, i.e. after some people had cycled back home if they were short-term workers or in some cases got deported. We're talking about 3 million English speakers from the various British Empire countries, not just the British Isles, but of course places like Canada and Australia and so forth. But we are talking about the English speakers, or in some cases Gaelic speakers here. 2.3 million were German speakers. That's not including things like Dutch and so forth. And obviously I broke out Yiddish earlier, so we're just talking about people who spoke the, you know, core German languages of Germany and Austria and so forth. 1.2 million were first language immigrant speakers of various Scandinavian countries, and nearly 500,000 were French speakers, and that includes, of course, French Canada as well. Very few people in the U.S., especially the entire U.S. geographically, were interacting with these small numbers of post-World War I immigrants, except for, obviously, Poles and probably Italians. And those would have been a big factor if you were in, you know, someplace like Chicago or New York or Boston or wherever. But again, they weren't necessarily spreading out through the entire country. And in certain areas, there would have been significant presences of Eastern European Jews. We did mention again that 1.09 million Yiddish speaking immigrants in 1920. But again, that's like relatively few people would have been interacting with or dealing with these people, and so it's kind of hard to see where this sort of panic was coming from. And if you add together all of the different Slavic-speaking immigrant groups, by my count, I think we're looking at around 2 million people out of 14 million immigrants and 106 million population total. So hard to see where this purported overrun is of Slavs, Latins, and Asiatic races. I mean, Latins, they're just talking about Italians and Spanish, I guess, and we already talked a little bit about the loophole with regard to Latin America, but Asiatic races, so to speak, if that's even a real thing, basically not immigrating to the U.S. at this point for various legal reasons and other factors, and the, as I said, the Slavic thing, we're talking about maybe 2 million people, roughly, in terms of first language speakers. There are obviously some additional caveats here. Many xenophobic politicians did not really distinguish between immigrants and their children. That would have inflated the numbers, or at least their perception of the numbers. As I said earlier, we have the 1920 census data now, but at the time they were passing these quotas, they were whipping up a frenzy in the absence of the actual numbers being available at that point, imagining what they were going to be. So some of this maybe looks sillier than it did at the time, although I don't really think that's an excuse. And it seems especially notable to me that some of the larger, or traditionally larger, immigration source countries that the U.S. seems to have familiarized itself with had not only declined in relative terms, but actually the immigrants from those countries declined over the 1910 to 1920 period in absolute terms, either through attrition or returning home. That gets back to that first half of that quote that Kelly mentioned earlier about the U.S. being historically peopled by British, German, or Scandinavian stock. And as I noted going through those statistics, if we're looking at the Scandinavian countries speakers, the Germanic speakers, the British Isles, and various other British Empire areas of English speakers, and the French, all of those groups of foreign language speakers did decline in the numbers of foreign-born immigrants when broken down by native language. And that, again, includes English for various countries. And that fact, as much as the increase, or perceived increase, I should say, in other new groups of immigrants from other parts of Europe, further south or east, must have sort of upended that sense of what was normal at the time and led to the idea that immigration wasn't per se a problem, but only if it came from certain countries. And we eventually see the further quota revisions later in the 1920s roll back from the 1910 to the 1890 census to really try to cut back on that so-called wrong country immigration, especially Italian immigration. And as we said earlier, you know, the Latin America question, they were being a little bit blurry there, I think, with their Spanish and Portuguese speakers as to whether or not they were from, you know, Southern Europe, so to speak, or just from Latin America, which wasn't actually restricted by the Emergency Quota Act of 1921. So, Kelly, that's a lot of numbers that I've gone through there and various data points, but I was wondering if any of those jumped out at you or things that you wanted to talk about.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like, as with many conversations about immigration, there doesn't really seem to be any sort of like defendable non-racist version of why this was so important at the time. This influx of folks that they imagined was happening wasn't happening to the extent at which it was sort of documented at the time. It doesn't really explain like the fervor around this. I wonder how much of this is really related to just like the change in people's experience in the world during and after the First World War. I mean, I think it would be hard to understate the effect of experiencing any sort of world war, let alone the first, and sort of realizing that you live in a world that is so interconnected, in which you do have to sort of become a global citizen and look beyond, you know, your neighborhood or even your country. And so I wonder how much of this is really related to just the anxiety about the changing world and about, you know, having to worry about what's going on in Europe, in other parts of the world. And that is sort of like an unanswerable question. But as I look at all this in the numbers you've just read, Bill, really reveal that this sort of influx wasn't happening quite like folks said it was happening. I'm really just curious about like what else was going on in people's minds at the time that led to this sort of immigration scapegoating.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's an obvious modern parallel when you ask people like, you know, what do you think the percentage of immigrants in the country is? Or the ever popular one, especially in Europe, is what percentage of the population do you believe is Muslim? Similar demographic question there. And people will, you know, look at a number that's very low single digits and be like, yeah, I'd say it's definitely in the 20 to 50% range. Like just completely wildly out of proportion to reality. And that's what these laws get based on and so forth. Another point that I think is worth noting here, which seems a little startling, is if we go back to that quote, just because it's such a good sort of explication of the mindset here, that quote from Prescott Hall from the Immigration Restriction League based out of Boston that Kelly read earlier, this is hailing the U.S., celebrating the U.S. as being historically, quote, peopled by British, German, or Scandinavian stock, historically free, energetic, progressive, end quote. This is right after World War I, when they've just been fighting the Germans, and there's been all this paranoia about German subversive activity in the United States, and to immediately pivot and be like, all of the Germans, always our friends, a core bedrock of American culture, et cetera, is just an astounding pivot. I mean, we did a whole episode talking about various sort of U.S. surveillance activities during the war on the German populations. That was a bonus episode that we did on the American Protective League. But an interesting and fascinating pivot to make there. And I will grant you, like, if you separate sort of paranoia from non-paranoia, many of the Germans who came to the United States were very much democratic liberals, especially if they came here after the failures of the revolutions in 1848. And of course, we've talked on previous episodes about communist and anarchist Germans in the Chicago area and so forth. So there's definitely like a very, I guess we'll call it progressive category of German immigrants, and they would not have been favorable toward the German Empire and the Kaiser and so forth. But again, we're talking about paranoia here. So where is this distinct? Why is the distinction being made there, but not being made with these other people? It just, you know, at a certain point, you've folded it in on itself. So you've got like, well, this paranoia was fine like 2 years ago or 3 years ago, but now we're on to a different paranoia and we actually like those other people.
I mean, you see that time and time again, even with my family happens to be quite Irish, so I often think of that. But the role of Irish immigrants in Boston going from certainly the undesirable nationality to then being considered, you know, white and then fitting into whatever like white tier of some socially constructed tier nationality system. And so I think that is a theme that is present over and over again in American history. There is no scientific backing to any of this. So it is just the opinion of the day of what is desirable and undesirable. And we have seen so many of our immigration populations, each of which brings something unique and special to the country, be scapegoated upon their arrival.
We're getting near the end here, but did you want to go over some of the sort of timeline stuff very briefly before this legislation and then what it led to subsequently?
Absolutely. So I think just to echo the point that this Act of 1921 did not happen in a vacuum, but was the result of decades of growing anti-immigration sentiment in an evolving world, goes back. The first inspection of immigrants actually happened in 1855 as Irish immigrants came fleeing the potato famine. And this is when we start thinking of Ellis Island as the sort of inspection center as immigrants came to the country and processed through. This was followed in 1882 by the Chinese Exclusion Act, which was just excluded folks from China. And then the 1907 Gentlemen's Agreement with Japan, which again further excluded people from Japan from immigrating to the United States. This Gentlemen's Agreement in 1907 was followed up in 1917 with an Immigration Act, again, specifically targeted at curtailing immigration from Japan. And in 1921, this Emergency Quota Act that we've been discussing established the first numerical limits on the number of immigrants. What's interesting is that by 1924, when the Emergency Quota Act was set to be renewed, people just took quotas for granted. And so there was no debate on whether or not these quotas should exist, but rather what the quotas should be. In the Immigration Act of 1924 made the quotas stricter and permanent by basing the quota figures on 1890 and no longer requiring the act to be renewed every 2 years. This 1819 census was key because it was before the second big wave of immigration by folks from Southern and Eastern Europe. This Immigration Act of 1924 instituted the visa process that we know today. And Ellis Island, as a result, was no longer used as that processing and detention center. But the immigration system really switched to the visas. And amazingly, this quota system, which was born out of the 1921 Emergency Quota Act, stayed in place until 1965, which I think is fascinating that this emergency act gave birth to these quotas that would be used for more than 40 years and also gave birth to the act that would institute the visa system that we still use today. And unfortunately, the legacy of this act does not end there. Jeff Sessions actually cited this 1924 act, which was the follow-up to the 1921 Emergency Quota Act, as a model. And so that just goes to show you how 100 years later, this Emergency Quota Act is just still so relevant today in the conversations we have about immigration and the policies which we discuss to govern it.
So one final thing I wanted to talk about is a local connection to me here in Newton, Massachusetts, where I am a city councilor. So Newton actually had one of the first sort of zoning codes in the country, and specifically one of the first exclusionary zoning codes. Now, obviously, part of the zoning objective is, you know, so you don't have like factories getting built next to people's houses and stuff like that. But exclusionary zoning basically says, you know, either certain people can't live here or more abstractly that, you know, only a certain class of people can live here via certain levers and controls like, you know, only single family houses with large lots can be constructed and that kind of thing. And Newton, of course, already had kind of a jumble and mix of various different neighborhoods and housing types and business types and things like that. And so some of this, you know, the cat was already out of the bag and they couldn't really do much about that, but they were trying to impose restrictions on the undeveloped areas of the city and so forth. And there was a letter to the editor in one of the local papers called the Newton Graphic on April 14th, 1922, which had a very interesting quote in support of this zoning code, which was initially vetoed a couple of times before eventually being passed and signed into law. Quote, "As a country, we are shutting the doors against undesirable immigrants. We are shutting out certain people from the country for the country's good. Has a city on a small scale to do as far as it can what the nation is attempting at a larger scale?" End quote. And I thought that was interesting because it's not only obviously a centennial tie-in, and it happens that we're doing a big zoning redesign in Newton right now, largely trying to amend some of the 1950s zoning and so forth and some of the parts that are still left over from the 1920s. But it's interesting that people were thinking of that locally and explicitly tying that into the Emergency Quota Act of 1921 and saying, look, it's actually good and desirable to try to limit who gets to live in certain places and to close your doors and so forth. So, Kelly, I guess I will leave it there. If you had any other concluding thoughts overall, I'd be happy to hear those. But otherwise, thank you for being on this week.
Yeah, just that there is still a lot of work to do on immigration in this country. So thanks for having me, Bill, for the chance to discuss this.
And again, as a reminder, as I said several times throughout the episode, if you subscribe to the bonus episodes on patreon.com/arsenalfordemocracy, we should be on later this week releasing a bonus episode about the 1920 census, which was, as we said, very complicated and very important and was not the basis of this legislation, but they were dealing with getting the results together around the same time, and this gap between the 1920 census and the 1910 census allowed them to sort of fill in the blanks with their own sort of paranoid fantasies and come up with this legislation in 1921. So again, that's patreon.com/arsenalfordemocracy, and we hope you'll become a subscriber for $5 a month. Thank you.